This workshop on leading a self-organizing team was conducted by Mike Cohn on January 28, 2009 at the Dallas Marriott Suites Market Center and was recorded with his permission.
Thanks to everybody for coming. I appreciate it. It's a new talk for me. This is a topic I've been real passionate about, though, but putting together as a talk for the first time. So we'll see if you're as passionate about this as I am by the time we're done. I want to talk about what is necessary to lead a self-organizing team. There's a lot of people that think that agile management is about, you hire a team and just completely get out of the way. And I think that's just a gross oversimplification of what we're going to do with an agile team. There are things that we can do with this agile team that I'm going to kind of put them into the category of subtle control, and I'll describe what that means. That's not even my phrase. The phrase subtle control is one that goes back to some of the absolute earliest agile literature. So I think we got about an hour or so of things I want to talk about tonight. Here's the agenda for what we've got. I want to start out by talking about what self-organization and subtle control are all about, what I mean when I'm saying this. Then we're going to talk about three things that influence how a team self-organizes. We're going to talk about containers, differences, and exchanges. This is something called the CDE model, Container Difference Exchange, CD&E model of self-organization. Then I want to talk about how you can influence how a team evolves over time. Teams aren't static entities, they change. So I want to talk about how the team evolves over time and your role as a leader or manager, someone with influence on that team, and how you can use that in a proactive manner to help the team evolve in ways that that we'd like to see them go. So we'll start out with what is a self-organizing team and what self-organization is about. There's a lot of confusion here. Some people call it self-managing or self-directed. I really do prefer the term self-organizing, and we can see why as we go through some of this. It's not self-directed. The team is given direction from outside in terms of go build this, go achieve this goal. What the team does is they organize around that goal. It's up to them to figure out how they're going to do this. So, we don't have a team that just gets to decide, we'd like to develop a new word processor, and the team sits around and says, well, that's okay, we'd rather write a video game. Right? We're not giving the team that level of authority in terms of how they self-organize. That's not what it's about. Sometimes, we're going to talk about this later, but sometimes the team might have authority over who's on the team. But self-organization doesn't even have to go that far. Self-organization does not necessarily imply that the team decides who will be part of the team. We'll talk about when it might later, but it doesn't have to go that far. The idea with self-organization is that it's about how the team is going to respond to external stimulus put on the team. A team's in an environment and their response is how they organize. And the team is going to be influenced in that and how they're structured. Who's put on the team, the goal that the team is given, what it is that they're after. So those are things we're going to be looking at that we as leaders or managers in an organization can do as we influence this team. The right way to think about a software development team is as what is known as a complex adaptive system. Now, we're not going to go into a lot of complexity science, but we're going to talk about one or two things this evening. A CAS, or Complex Adaptivist System, I like there's a number of definitions out there for them. I like John Holland's best. And as I go through this, think about whether you think this applies to teams that you've been part of. So according to Holland, a Complex Adaptive System, or a CAS, is a dynamic network of many agents, people, teams, subsets of teams interacting. Those would all be agents. So a dynamic network of many agents acting in parallel, we're all moving at the same time, acting and responding to what other actors are doing. What other agents are doing, right? So I don't just get to do what I want to do in a vacuum. I do it in response to what your team is doing or what you as another programmer on the team are doing. Control is highly dispersed and decentralized. Right? One person doesn't get to say, do it this way, and it all magically happens. Right? The control on the project is kind of spread out among everybody on there. Somebody might say, do this. And even if they say, do this or I'll fire you, odds are they can't fire me that day, right? HR's got to get involved and all that type of stuff, right? So control is dispersed. Just because somebody says do it, it doesn't mean it happens. Overall system behavior is the result of a huge number of interactions. The decisions that are made, this determines how the behavior is. There's not one person controlling all these things. So if we think about a team, I think this describes how our teams work. Right? Our teams are a number of independent people, each with their own goals. Yes, hopefully moving towards some bigger unified goal. Right? And interacting in these ways. There's no one controlling entity. Not even in a waterfall project. I mean, of course not in an agile project. So I think this describes how our teams work. What do you think? Am I right on this? Does this sound completely wrong? What do you think?
Literally right.
Right? Okay. One of the things you learn, I mentioned this, because this is great coaching advice. One of the things you learn if you're going to coach an agile team, right? You know, you ask them, how should we do this? You have to learn how to count. To be a good coach or scrum master, you have to learn how to count. Because a lot of times the team will look for you to make a decision for them. Right? And so what I learned early on as a scrum master was when the team was waiting for me to make a decision, I would just start counting in my head. One, two, three. I've got way up into the hundreds. I got over 1,000 with one team. It was waiting for me to decide. Think about how long it takes to just count to 1,000 in your head, right? So if I ask a question and people don't respond, I'll just stand here and count. I can count pretty high. Right? So thank you. Yeah, I do. I seriously do think this is the right way to think about our teams. Right? Now, let's see some examples, other examples besides just a software team of what we might mean with a complex adaptive system. An ant colony or a beehive, right? There's a queen bee, right? But she's not making decisions and controlling things, right? Flock of geese heading south, right? You watch how they change patterns and things like this. Us right now, we self-organized, right? You chose to sit there, you chose to sit there, right? We self-organized in a particular pattern, right? We'll see more on how we chose to sit the way we are. Think about a crowd batched up to get into a concert. I went to a concert a couple months ago, and it was in Las Vegas. It was in this kind of fancy ballroom to get in, and everybody's standing there. And, people queued up in a certain way. These are complex adaptive systems. Preparing a meal, family preparing a meal. Driving home on a crowded highway, right? The cars and the drivers interacting on there. These are all complex adaptive systems. There's not one person saying, do this, you drive here, you merge here, right? There might be rules in place that are starting out how we're supposed to behave on the freeway, right? Two cars merge at a time through this green light, whatever the rule is locally. And, of course, our software team. So when we talk about influencing or controlling a team, control is not evil. People like to pick on. With Agile, you hear a lot of criticism. Oh, we don't want command and control. I'm totally on board with that. We don't want command and control. But I'm more against the command than I am against the control. Right? And I don't even want to control a team in some vast, big, manipulative manner. That is not what I'm after. And I'll have a slide that's commenting on that. That's not what this is about. But control itself is not evil. Right? Again, we hire a team and we say, you're going to write a word processor. That's a level of control. And I haven't met a team yet that felt like that was so evil and as part of being an agile team, they should be able to decide whatever product they're going to build. Right? And say, no, we're not building a word processor, we're doing this instead. Right? So control itself isn't evil. Right? Control can be exerted in a bunch of subtle rules and influences that we set up on a team. Right? I don't feel like I'm being overly constrained by being told in the US, let's drive on the right side of the road. Right? Seems like a pretty easy way for us to be able to coordinate our work. Right, a nice simple rule that we can all follow. Let's drive on the right side of the road. I go to one and it's the opposite, of course. Right? We think about bio teams. Right? Teams in nature. Bees might have a goal underneath there of produce honey. Right? So we've got these subtle goals and influences acting on us. So for our teams that we're working with, our software teams, our self-organizing teams, rules and incentives are going to be added by us. Right? We can put rules and incentives on top of these teams that are going to exert what's called subtle control on how they behave. And I contend that that's not a bad thing. Now, I want to show you that I'm not alone in this thought, so I want to bring up a couple of slides and have some quotes on here. This one is from Philip Anderson, a recognized kind of business professor and complexity scientist guy. It's a great book called Biology of Business. And his quote up here says, self-organization does not mean that workers instead of managers engineer the organization's design. It does not mean letting people do whatever they want to do. Again, none of us think it does. It means that management commits to guiding the evolution of behaviors that emerge from the interaction of independent agents, or our complex adaptive system and agents, instead of specifying in advance what effective behavior is. Right? So what I'm saying, here's exactly what you have to do. We say, here's the goal we want. We're going to set up the incentives to work in the right way. Right? So self-organization doesn't mean turning control over to the employees. It doesn't mean, hey, you go figure everything out. Here's another one. I've got a couple of these. And this is from the very first article on Scrum, 1986, in the Harvard Business Review, Takeuchi and Nonaka. Very famous article that talked about Scrum. And here's what they said. They said, although project teams are largely on their own, they are not uncontrolled. Management establishes enough checkpoints to prevent instability, ambiguity, and tension from turning into chaos. They're saying we like these things. We like certain amounts of instability, ambiguity, and tension. Right? We want the team under pressure to figure out how to deliver something that would be hard to do. If it's not hard to do, don't use Scrum. Go use some simple process. So these things are good things, but management puts enough checkpoints in to avoid problems. At the same time, management avoids the kind of rigid control that impairs creativity. They go on to talk about the term subtle control. Subtle control is also mentioned in the next reference that we really had at all about Agile back in the 80s. The next reference was in a book that came out in 1990 called Wicked Problems, Righteous Solutions. This is the one that really started to popularize Scrum at first. Became kind of a popular cult book in the early 90s. And they have a quote in here. They said, let me build up on how this quote gets into their book. They talk about Scrum and they say, oh, this must sound really chaotic. You're reading this right now. This must sound horribly out of control. And they say, it's not. To be sure, control is exercised, but it is subtle and much of it is indirect. Right? So I'm not alone in thinking about this. We absolutely exert subtle control over how the team is going to behave. But this is not some secret thing. I'm not some puppet master behind the scenes manipulating my team. Most of the things that we're going to want to do are things I'd be totally open with the team about. Right? Oh, I'm doing this for this reason. There might be a few where I don't want to say that to the team. And we can look for examples of that as we go through tonight. But I'm not trying to do anything secret or underhanded or without the team's knowledge. This isn't meant to be anything like that. So I'm not talking about, hey, let's learn how to lead a self-organizing team without them knowing about it. And that way we can manipulate them and control them. It's not about bad things in that way. So let's talk about containers, differences, and exchanges. The idea here is that in order to self-organize, we need three things. We need to have each of these things. We need to have a container, some differences, and exchanges. Let's see what these mean. Containers. The container is the thing that groups a set of individuals together, groups those agents together. The container right now for us, this room. We have chose to self-organize within this room. Now we're a self-organizing team within this room. There's another group of people in the lobby. They've chosen how to self-organize in the lobby. Some are standing, some are sitting down. They are not interacting with us. They're not in the same container with us. So we can't be said to have self-organized with them. So in order to self-organize, you need a group of agents, group of people in the same container. Now, containers can take all sorts of forms. Some of the containers are physical, the one we're in right now. Some containers can be professional. They can be, I'm a programmer, somebody else is a tester, somebody else is a DBA. So our containers can be, I'm a U.S. citizen. I have certain things in common with the other U.S. citizens. We have some Italians on our team, some over in Italy, some here. Right? So containers can be cultural, they can be physical. A container could be we're part of the Sunnyvale campus. Right? We're in California, we're part of the Sunnyvale campus. There's another part of our team that's part of the Austin campus, whatever that may be. So lots of different containers can exist, and an individual could be in multiple at the same time. Oh, project. Yeah, that one was up there. The project is a container. We are on this project. We might be in five different physical containers, but the project is a container around us. Differences. This is an easy one with people. Of course, we're going to have differences among people. Right? But we have to have some differences among the agents that are interacting in order for self-organization to occur. Right? Otherwise, if everything's in common, we're not going to be able to self-organize because there'd be no point to it. There'd be no reason for a particular shape to our organization. Now, differences can be on all different dimensions. Gender, knowledge, experience with the domain, experience with the technology. These are all differences that we're going to have. Now, when we think about putting a team together, think about what we might be doing with these differences. I might want to have more differences on a team. Maybe this team is too similar, and let's mix it up. Let's bring on somebody with some vastly different experience. Maybe this team is too diverse, right? Let's make this team less diverse. It's got too much diversity right now. So those are some of the things we might do as we think about these. The last part, transforming exchanges. We need exchanges. We need the people on the team in the self-organizing system to interact and be transformed by that interaction. I'll give you an example. You and I go over and we talk to our product owner, that key stakeholder for our product. Then we say, how are things going? And the product owner says, oh, I just got back from a client visit. This thing's going to be hot. These clients are excited about this. We've got to figure out a way to get this thing out sooner. And we're going to make so much money off this. It's going to be wonderful. People are dying for this product. Well, I might leave that conversation feeling pretty energized. I'm pretty motivated. Wow, that sounds great. I knew we had a good product, but I didn't know it was going to be that great. So that's a transforming exchange. I leave energized from that. Might have another conversation. Maybe one of the junior people on the team comes and wants to talk to me about a particular observer pattern and how should we implement this. And he and I talk, and he leaves after a transforming exchange. He's got a little bit more knowledge. Right? So knowledge was transferred in that exchange. So we need all three of these things in order to be able to self-organize. And how these are set up in the organization, how these are set up on the team, are going to influence how that team does self-organize. Yes?
In your catalog, I think it was a catalog of scrum smells, one of them was, I think, specialization in the team where only members can only do certain things, mm-hmm. which seemed a little counter to that differences thing. Could you comment on that?
Yes. I wrote an article many years ago saying, here's some smells, some problems on scrum teams, and one of them was if you have a team where there's no cross-fertilization of skills. I do this, you do that, and everybody has their own specialty, and nobody has any ability to do anything else. It's kind of a warning sign that you'd like to address. Some domains, that's going to be more true than others. It's going to have to be that way. But when I have that, I'd like to be able to resolve that problem. What we're talking about here with differences is we have to have people who have differences among them. In some ways, this doesn't even count because there's no way you're not going to have this with people, right? We're all different. We've all got different specialties, preferences, skill sets. So I'm not saying that we can't have... I'm not saying that I want everybody on the team to be a generalist who can do programming in Java and .NET and in our SQL Server database as well as do testing. All right, we're not saying that. You and I might have all of those skills, but you prefer doing one and I prefer doing a different one. Right? So we've got differences among us. Now we've got something that's going to allow us to self-organize. Right? If everything was identical, it wouldn't matter how we organized.
Right.
So we wouldn't have any care about which each of us did. So the way we're going to use some of this information with these CDs and E's, you can influence the organization by adjusting these. If we think about the containers that exist on a team, you can alter the formal teams, the informal teams that exist. You can clarify the expectations you have of a team. And here, team, here's what I want from you by the end of this project. 3 months from now, here's what we want. That's clarifying their expectations. In some ways, you can think of that as tightening their container. I put them in a smaller container. Here's exactly what I want. Some teams, maybe you want to widen the container. Say, well, a word processor. I don't know if it should compete with Word. Maybe it should compete with one of those word processors that is only a script writing tool. Right? Movie script writers can buy a word processor just for them. Right? Maybe it should be more of a technical documentation word processor. I don't know what we want to do with our word processor product, but we have a goal to cram out with a word processor in 2010. Go build it. Right? So I can tighten or broaden that goal that's given the team. That's altering their container. How I do that, or when I do that, I will change how they self-organize. Differences. Dampen or amplify the differences. Right? Put somebody else on the team that has a completely different decision-making style. Right? Maybe you've got a team right now that has gotten into a mode where they're too nice to each other. They don't want to argue about things. Everybody's just kind of too nice. And they may disagree, but yeah, I don't want to rock the boat. That was a good enough approach. Well, move on somebody on the team who's kind of obnoxious and doesn't do that. Right? Mix that team up. It'll be a little hard for them at first. They'll struggle with that. Maybe they'll all end up better. And the point of that, you don't actually know it'll end up better, so you're having to go with your intuition here and experience from what you've seen with other teams. So dampen or amplify differences. Exchanges. Insert new exchanges into the process. Say, you know, I like where you guys are going with this, but I really think we need to have all of our architectural decisions approved by Dave. Right? You know, Dave's not the official like company, the senior architect who has to approve everything. That's not his official job. But he's a smart guy, and I've talked to him, and I really want him, because he's done projects like this, I'd really like to have our designs run by him. Right? So maybe we decide to insert an interaction like that. Maybe we've got a committee like that that already does it, and I decide that's a bad idea. It's hurting us, and I find a way as a scrum master or coach for that team to insert myself and make that go away. Right? So add or remove exchanges that may need to happen. Maybe your team needs to get in touch with customers. Right? This team doesn't see the urgency to this product. They don't think this is any sort of big deal that we have a lot of bugs coming in. Let's get them in touch with some customers. That would be inserting a new exchange into how they work. This is what I'm after with subtle control. So leading a self-organizing team is not just saying, hey, what toppings do you want on your pizza? Right? And then just kind of leaving them alone. These are all things that we do as the leaders and managers in these groups to have this subtle influence on how they're going to behave. So let's look a little bit more at a couple of these things, and I'm going to ask you to think through a couple of situations. Some of these we've probably seen. Containers. Change the size of the team. Right? You might have a total favoritism for seven-person teams. You've been doing Agile for a couple of years. You've decided that six- and seven-person teams are the best. There might be a reason why you want to make your team a little bit bigger. Right? Make that team a little bit bigger. Shake things up. See what happens. Make it smaller. Right? And change the responsibility boundary. I was with a team that was having some problems, and they were at the end of each, they were a scrum team, at the end of each sprint, their goal was to have the system ready to deploy. It was a website, they didn't deploy it, another group deployed it. Well, they were having problems with that group. They weren't interacting very well together. So what we did is we decided we would extend the responsibility of this team. We said, you're responsible not only for having it ready to deploy, but deployed. Right? Go find a way to get that team to come work with you during the sprint. Get it deployed in the sprint. Right? So we increased the level of their responsibility. They had more to do. Change the team membership, create new teams. Right? All sorts of ways of changing the containers. Differences. Don't require consensus. Right? Some teams like to drive things to consensus. Maybe get involved and ask the coach or scrum master on this team, say, look, I'm not happy with how we're making decisions. I'd like to try things a little bit differently. Let's make decisions without having to take everything all the way to consensus. Let's just kind of get to maybe a majority opinion. Maybe do the opposite. Different team, do the opposite. Right? One of my favorite takes is I like asking hard questions. I love asking hard questions to teams, not because I care so much what the answer they give me is, but I want to hear have they thought through it well enough. Right? So I'll ask them questions, really hard questions about their application. And if they're able to give me good answers, I'll probe more and I'll probe more. But I want to see what they're thinking and have they thought about the hard things. What's our strategy if this happens? What are we going to do if we don't get that performance? You know, you think we're going to, and sounds like we will, but do we have a backup plan? You know, why do we think that's going to work? Ask hard questions of the team. Just kind of amplifying the differences. See where they think about things. And the last one before we practice some of these, seeing how these fit together, the transforming exchanges. Some of the things we can do with the transforming exchanges. Who isn't talking that should? Who's talking too much? Right? What can we do to mix things up? Are there reporting relationships that we could change? Right? Maybe you need to go to, you're a scrum master, go talk to their bosses and see if you can have somebody report differently or something. Move people around. We're always talking about getting people together. That's a good idea. Most of the time, maybe not in one case. Are there external groups we have to comply with? What do we have to do to get people to be doing more learning during the iteration? These are some things that we can do that are going to alter our exchanges. So we've got containers, differences, exchanges. Three things to think about when we're struggling with a team situation. The way I use this, I don't sit around thinking about these things all day, but when I'm coaching a team, and if the team is facing a problem, First off, sometimes something just instantly comes to mind. Oh, I've seen this problem before. Here's a good solution, right? That's great. That comes to mind. But I get a lot of problems, and I'm like, yeah, I don't know what to do. How should we handle this? When I'm stuck with something like that, I often fall back on this as a thinking tool for thinking through the problem. Okay, wow, they're struggling with that. I wonder if we should change a container. I wonder if we should alter their exchanges. And I think about the things that are going on here. I might draw out a picture of how I think that team looks in regard to this. And then think about what to change. Let me give you an example. What I'm going to ask you to do, a little exercise. I'm not going to be talking the whole time. I'm going to ask you to do a little bit. I'm going to give you a couple of scenarios here and ask you to think through this scenario, thinking as a group at your table, what would you do? Right? Come up with at least one thing that you would try, that you would change in this situation, and be thinking about it in terms of whether that's a container, a difference, or an exchange. Sometimes what you come up with might fall into two categories. That's fine. These aren't all clear cut. They're just a way to think about it. So let's do one together as a group. And then we'll have a couple up here that you can look at and think about. So the one I want to do as a group here, you've got a team, number one up here. The team consists of four developers, two testers, a database engineer, and you as a scrum master or coach. The developers and testers are not working well together. Yeah, fighting. Developers work in isolation until 2 days are left in the iteration. Right? 2 days left in the iteration, they hand everything over the wall to the testers. Right? What are some things you might change in this situation? What might you change in a situation like this? And do you think it's a container, a difference, or an exchange? What do you think? What might you do? What?
Expand the container so they don't think of themselves as being separate.
Okay, but give me more specifically how you might expand that container.
Well, developers are reported to like team lead and have that team lead instead of be overseeing all sorts of people.
Okay, so maybe I can change the reporting relationship, have them report all to the same person who can work on that behavior.
Maybe have an exchange early on and have them come up with tests together before the development run starts.
Okay. So it might be with the team, so it would be a good idea by halfway through the sprint, we have to identify the test plans or test cases or something. I'm introducing an exchange.
We also change the physical container, put the testers right next to the developers. They had to work together.
And, now we might be looking at that going, but they're already sitting together. I've got five programmers, a couple DBAs, and the testers. No, maybe programmer, tester even, right? I mix them up even more. It's not just good enough they're in the same room, perhaps. Any other thoughts?
Pull the testers? So
just yank on them?
Take an iteration with them out.
So oh.
Reduce the team by two and make the developers responsible for everything the testers did.
Mm-hmm. Let them see what it's like. I did that. I had a project where the programmers said, our job is to write the best possible code we can to come up with elegant solutions to problems. And the programmer and the testers were saying, but the solutions you're coming up with are hard to test. And the programmer said, well, doesn't matter. We're coming up with the best possible solution. Go figure out a way to test it. And I was a consulting scrum master of the project, I said, yeah, this is all great, but I've got a rule that programmers are not allowed to test the user, that testers are not allowed to test the user interface. Right? I want testers focused on things below there. Any manual user interface testing has to be done by programmers. Right? Now, when you tell the programmers they're responsible for the manual user interface testing, all of a sudden, they find ways to make that UI automatable. Right? And they did. Within about two sprints, they had found ways to automate the entire user interface. So very similar to what you're describing there. It's a good approach. Okay. Any others?
We're trying a unique approach. We're seeing if our developers can have what we're calling mini demos.
Uh-huh.
To get the testers involved so they can see what's coming before the last 2 day crunch.
So you've introduced an exchange, right? You've said, look, halfway through, let's do a demo, or whenever it is through here, let's have a demo, right? That's introducing an exchange. So good. So what I'm after with thinking about these CDs and E's, the containers, differences, and exchanges, is they're a thinking tool. My team has a problem. What can I do to get this problem going a little bit better? Okay? So let me put up one of these. I'll give you a few minutes to think about it, and then we'll move on to another one. I've got a handful of these things up here. I didn't think about them not being able to hand you five of them and say, hey, just work on these. So let me give you one. We'll work on it for a couple minutes, then I'll bring up the next two and give you a few minutes to work on that one. So I'd like you in your groups to spend a couple minutes thinking about this one. In this case, the team is failing to deliver potentially shippable software at the end of the sprints, the end of the iterations. None of the items they start are 100% finished. They're close, but there's always work left to be done in the next iteration. The team's getting a lot of work done. You're kind of happy with the quantity of work from what you can tell, but none of it is truly 100% finished. You know, a lot of stuff half done, a lot of what they call 80% done. So, spend a couple minutes at your table, think about what you might change on this one the way we just did. And kind of think through it in the container difference exchange mode. What containers might we change, etc. Here's two more. I'll read them to you because you may not be able to read it in the back. Number three, the team seems to be consistently under-committing during their iteration or sprint planning. They're not doing much. They finished the work they commit to, but it doesn't seem like much. Product owner hasn't complained yet, but you're worried she might soon. Sounds like somebody's been there. Number four, your company's got 20 different agile teams. Each team has its own testers. Those testers are starting to go in different directions, maybe looking at different tools, different ways of doing things. What do you do in those situations? So talk about those two, the undercommitting team and the testers starting to diverge. Let's just talk about one of these for a second. Let's do number three. The team's undercommitting. They finish what they do, but they don't seem to be doing much. Product owner hasn't complained yet, but is likely to do so soon. Any suggestions on that one? And what would they have been? What do you have?
Well, our first thought was to combine that team with the Uber
Good approach. That would be changing the containers, right? Might be also changing the differences.
We thought we'll add more differences into the team.
Okay.
By bringing in outsiders into the team, because we thought like the team is thinking alike.
Uh huh.
And that's why they're always underestimating.
Undercommitting. Yeah, bring an outsider, bring another team member in, and bring in one that is very different from this team, that hasn't worked with these five people recently, right? Doesn't hang out with them at the bowling alley after work, whatever. You know, try to bring in somebody that's very different. Other thoughts?
Well, just have an exchange, because a lot of times people undercommit because of fear of failure. And just make sure that they understand that it's okay, that some things are prioritized and something may slip to the next sprint. That's not a horrible thing.
So one of the ways I might do that is I might make sure they go with me at the end of this sprint to another team's sprint review that didn't have to drop something, right? And watch that team not get yelled at. Right? So, I just hope they don't. Right? It's like, that was the day the product owner didn't have their three Starbucks, right? And the product owner goes off on the team. No, I wouldn't stage. That's going to be artificial. I know you didn't mean that way. But these would be other exchanges that I could introduce in here. Right? Okay. So, I saw a couple hands. Yeah?
Are you thought of a container change by reducing the size of the team? To change the dynamic and the
aspiration. I might want to reduce the size of the team. That'll have a couple impacts. They won't know exactly how much to commit to anymore, right? Might change how they make decisions. Now, we heard change the team size, make it bigger, make it smaller. Okay, this is hypothetical, so I don't know which is the best solution. If I had the particular people there, if I knew who was available, who'd been working together, I'd be much more inclined to say one's better than the other, right? Hypothetical, who knows which is better. I saw one other hand on the corner of my eye, yeah.
We have two ideas. One was to change the size of the container in terms of the scope. So with traditional Agile, you're only looking a couple of iterations or a couple sprints ahead. If you were to go through, this may be more of an exchange thing, but if you went through an exercise where you took their current velocity and you mapped out how much work it would take to get to the end, and they realized that that would put them in 2012, they would probably rethink, you know, how aggressively they're estimating. The other is you could break up the teams and make it more of a, just what Kurt was suggesting, it more of a competitive style where they can see that one team is going down points faster.
Well, you can get that competitive style as well. I was thinking that with the same thing with the sprint review. Take them to another sprint review, same size team. I don't care if they missed or, you know, I'm not taking them for that purpose. And let them look at how much that team did, right? And make sure it's a team that shows, like, their sprint burn down chart showing how many hours they worked and those things. Right? And just let them look at that. It's like, ooh, wow, you know, they seem to be doing a lot more than we do. right? Maybe even bring that up in the next retrospective. You know, hey, we went and watched that other team to hear how their sprint was going, and they're committing to a lot more hours than we are. I mean, are there just hours padded and it's no big deal? Or is there something we can do to get more productive? Right? I'm not saying stop sandbagging. I'm going to ask, you know, how can we get more productive? And then there came up with things like, well, you know, I personally have spent a lot of time supporting this old application. And yeah, it's 5 minutes, but, you know, you think it's a lot of time, right? But, you know, let them come up with their reasons why their time isn't available. And let them resolve those. So, okay, lots of good answers. Hopefully you're seeing some of the power of this. This is nothing new. Most of you have done things like this. What I'm trying to do is establish that there's this framework for how we might think of how to interact with our team. Containers, differences, and exchanges. I find a very powerful way to interact with my teams. I just skipped over one of the slides and a couple more. Let's talk about how to influence how the team evolves. Teams move along what is called a self-organizing path. The self-organizing path is indicative of the fact that the team is not the same over time. The team starts out one way, they change how they do it, they evolve, they end up in a different place. And so a team is continually changing. They're continually self-organizing around other stimulus hitting the hitting their environment. Right, other stimuli hit their environment, and they have to respond around that. As you see that team self-organize, you can influence its path. Right? You can influence how it's moving along. You can't control it. You can't say, I want you to end up here. Right? You don't know exactly how the team is going to respond. Think back to a lot of the suggestions we just heard. Take them to a meeting, right? Change the team size. We take them to a meeting and the guy does blow up, right? Because we don't stage it. I can't control how they're going to interpret those messages they hear. I can influence it. I can't control it, right? So we can view this as the way the team evolves over time. Another quote from Philip Anderson, scientist referenced earlier. And he says, self-organization proceeds from the premise that effective organization is evolved, not designed. You don't get to sit there and say, here's exactly the right organization for us. It has to be evolved over time. It aims to create an environment in which successful divisions of labor and routines not only emerge, but self-adjust in response to environmental changes. Right? You want the team to be able to respond as their environment changes. This happens because management, here's us, sets up an environment and encourages rapid evolution towards higher fitness, right? More fitness for our environment, better suited for the environment. Not because management has mastered the art of planning and monitoring workflows. Right? So we don't have to master the art of planning and knowing exactly what needs to be done. We want to set up a team that can respond quickly to changes in its environment, that can evolve as its environment changes. Now, if we think about evolution, and how animals and others alter over time. It's been said that for evolution, we need these three things: variation, selection, and retention. The idea here would be to think of a giraffe. Right? Giraffe is born. One is born a little bit of a mutation. It has a longer neck than others. Right? That's a variation. That giraffe is able to reach food that other giraffes can't. That long neck helps it. Helps it to be able, more likely to survive, more likely to breed and have successors then. That's called the selection part of this. We have the variation, the random mutation that occurs. Selection is the fact that mutation is kept. It's selected as a good thing. And then retention, passing that mutation along to its ancestor, its descendants. So we have these three things. We've got variation, selection, and retention going on. So what we want to do is think about some of this in how our organization evolves. Which things in our organization are we going to be able to influence in terms of the level of variation, selection, and retention? Right. Let me show you a couple examples of how this is going to work. This Philip Anderson that I've referenced a couple times, great approach in terms of saying, there's seven levers that we can use to influence how teams evolve. And here are seven levers. I want to explain how each of these levers apply to software development. By the way, I'll post all the slides on my website tonight if I have a good internet connection. If not, it'll be tomorrow. So you'll be able to get all these off of the mountainwebsoftware.com website. So let's look at Anderson's levers here. The first one he has is selecting the external environment. By selecting the external environment, we can influence how this team evolves over time. Now, some of these you're going to see some relationships here with the containers, differences, and exchanges, of course. So the external environment is more than just the physical environment that the team exists in. In some levels, it's the business we're in. Yeah, okay, maybe we can't change that one, right? Maybe somebody in the organization can. But it's all sorts of things about that business. How do we feel about innovation? Are we trying to be an innovative company? Or are we just trying to take ideas that others come up with and make them a whole lot better? Right? Maybe we're a fast follower, different type of company. How do we as a company feel about mistakes? Right? Is it okay to try things? No, we don't want to fail. Right? Is it okay to try things as long as we learn if we do fail? What's our company culture towards things like that? That's all part of establishing the external environment. Think about being in a company where failure is perfectly fine as long as we learn from it and pick ourselves up and move on. Versus being in a company where, if you ever fail on something, you're probably going to be fired as soon as the next project starts. Right? There are just companies like both. I've been in companies that work both ways. Right? And you're going to have different types of behavior, different ways the teams will work together. One of the things that we as managers and leaders influence, the types of projects that we work on, how big those projects are, the rates at which they're fed into the organization, that's a big part of what we can control, often can control, is how fast new projects are being fed into the organization. Which ties in with this last one, what is our company expectation on focus? Right? Do we expect to be able to put people on one project, let them focus? Or are we the type of company that puts everybody on five projects? Oh, we're going to get more done when everybody's on five projects, right? Kind of a pet peeve of mine because it's completely BS. Right? Teams that focus, companies that focus on fewer projects at a time get more done. Right? So select our external environment. Second lever we can use to influence the evolutionary path of a team. Define performance. Indicate what good performance is. Right? Model that good performance for your team members. Right? So we think back to our variation, selection, and retention. Right? The principle of selection says that the traits that help us survive will be the ones retained. What traits help people survive in your organization? Remember one of the last companies I worked in before I decided that, I'm a consultant for life. One of the last companies I was in, what helped you survive? Political skill. Right? Not what I want to be favoring in an organization, right? But people who could play the political game the best were the ones who were going to survive. So what messages are you sending to teams, right? What type of behavior are you modeling for teams, right? These are all going to influence how those teams behave. Think about short-term versus long-term performance, right? How strongly do we discount the future? Right? We only care about the present. Well, that can be perfectly fine. I got a friend who's in a startup. They started up about 2 years ago. They just kind of finished their software. They started pitching it to some VCs to get through this last round. They're really struggling right now. Not the best economy to be a startup trying to get your product through that last hurdle and released. I wouldn't expect him to be valuing the future very highly relative to the short term. Right, they got to get through the next 3 and 6 months. After that, future's great. Right, other companies I'd expect to have a little bit more focus on the long term. So both can be appropriate. I'm not saying one's better than the other. But what messages are we sending? If we send all sorts of messages that Q2's it, right? There's no horizon past the second quarter. Are we sending very good messages to teams in terms of what they should be doing in terms of investing in writing high quality code? Or should they just write the fastest thing they can to get this product out? So what type of messages do we send to people? Right? Think about some of these things in terms of what these imply about the long-term versus the short-term. A company that provides training, that provides the ability to work at a sustainable pace, doesn't try to burn people out. Right? I've worked in companies that do both. Companies that try to burn people out, kind of in it for the short-term. Right? So you're sending different messages to teams. Third lever that we can use to influence a team's evolutionary path, manage meaning. Manage what has meaning in the organization. Meaning often comes from the stories that are told in an organization. Right? What type of stories are told in the organization? The myths and the rituals that are repeated. Right? Hewlett-Packard, you're always hearing about Hewlett and Packard starting in their garage and things like that. Right? What type of stories do we hear? What gives meaning to work in our environment? So think about those. I've got one example. This was a great company I worked at. This was 1994, and the company had been profitable. We were a public company. We'd been profitable, and the company undertook a huge investment to reinvent themselves. Reasonably small company. Huge investment to reinvent themselves, and we took ourselves from a situation where we were nice, profitable, little company, public but little, and huge investment made us, so we were losing money for a few quarters, but with the promise of coming out of that much bigger. And so we were doing this. We kind of abandoned our successful initial product. We started writing the next generation product. And I remember we had this chart that the CEO drew. He called it the Valley of Death. And it showed revenue from the old product, and over the time it was going like this, because we were deciding we're not going to spend any time on this. That's not where it was a healthcare product. That is not where the future of healthcare is. We're going to abandon that product. While we're abandoning that, we're going to be developing a new product. It's going to take time to ramp up and get interest. And he said, we're entering the Valley of Death, where we've got declining revenue here, barely starting revenue for the new product. We've got to get out of that Valley of Death fairly quickly, otherwise we go down as a company. He led us very successfully through this, but I remember one of the things that he did as we're coming to the first quarter where we might be able to be profitable coming out of this, he makes this grand announcement that we're going to be taking all of the toilet paper out of the bathrooms, and it's nice two-ply toilet paper, you know, like Charmin, and we're replacing it with one-ply toilet paper, right? We're replacing it with lower-cost, worse toilet paper. What a stupid thing. Except his point was this. He said, I want you once a day thinking about the profitability of this company, and one ply costs half of what two ply does. Now, in the grand scheme of things, I'm sure this cost him money, right? We already owned the two ply toilet paper, right? This cost him money. But this was a story that got told around that company. Right? This was became part of the folklore of the company. Right? Now, imagine if you were looking at things and you know you wanted to spend a little bit of money on something. Right? You probably held off a little bit more than you might have otherwise. Right? And we did. We became profitable that quarter. It was very hard to do, but you know, we cut back on just about any expenses we could to try to become profitable that quarter. And we made it. And that company did go on tremendous success. Right? So that's the type of story that gets told. I went to visit this other company. They would have been a great client for me. They would have been a great client. They're in Boulder. They need a lot of help. They're a big name. Everybody would know their name. They would have been a great client. And I spend the first couple hours talking to various people. And then I'm meeting, for some reason, with the HR director. And the HR director tells me, oh, you're going to love our new GM. We've got this new general manager. You're going to love him. He's wonderful. Every day at 5 o'clock, he goes out and counts the cars in the parking lot. And this guy's happy because, you know, he thinks that way we're going to keep people in the office, right? We're going to make them work harder. And, you know, so this is the story they're telling around the company about this GM, about what a hard ass he is. You know, he goes out and counts cars in the parking lot at 5 o'clock. And my response, this is a client I would have loved to have had, but my response to them was, oh, that's wonderful. I got to meet this guy. Some guy who goes out in the parking lot at 5 p.m. to make sure everybody has already gone home? Right? And what does he do? Go make sure the others leave as quick as possible? What a great guy. Right? He's going to be wonderful for Scrum. And this HR director was just totally shocked at, you know, my reaction to this, because it was the opposite of his. Right? And you know, he was kind of floored by that. And he goes, well, you know, let me go get him, and you know, you guys can talk. And I just left. I just walked out. I just, you know, this company was beyond help. I just left. So you know, what type of stories are we hearing in the organization? Right? This is how we can control meaning, influence meaning. Choose the people. This is one of the biggest influences that we have as managers and leaders. I'm going to go back to the early paper on Scrum, the 1986 paper that we had referenced earlier up here, Takeuchi and Nonaka, and then the one from the Wicked Problems, Righteous Solutions book. They talk about how there is absolutely control exerted over the team. Much of it is subtle and indirect. And they talk about how a big part of the control is who you put on the team. Right? So who we put on the team has tremendous influence on how that team will self-organize. Right? These are the containers, differences, and exchanges to some level. right? Repeated on this one. So who's on the team is going to influence that, right? So adjust any factor that you think might influence the team. No, probably not eye color, right? I saw a couple of you seeing that one. But whatever you think might influence how that team is going to self-organize is something to consider when you're doing this. Remember this one team I worked with, I needed them to stay together. We had acquired their company, and they were going through a lot of turmoil. We had been fierce competitors. We acquired their company, and they weren't happy about it, right? They'd looked on us as evil for the last few years. You know, now all of a sudden we acquire them. You know, like imagine Microsoft buying Linux, right? And, you know, Linux guys are, you know, going to cash the check and then going to be really hard to, you know, so how do they get along? And so we acquired this company that for the last 5 years it just hated us. And I needed this new team, this one of the new teams I managed, to stay together. And so I got to know the people on the team, and I found one of the guys, and he wasn't any better than any of the others. There was nothing that really qualified him to be the team leader, but I needed to kind of point somebody in that office to be my guy in charge of that office, and do all just whatever necessary for the office. And I knew the team would look at whoever I picked in some ways as the leader, because that person would be spending more time with me, and I was the vice president. And so they had one guy on the team, this guy named Darren, and Darren was a good guy. But he's one of these guys that I consider to be kind of like glue, right? He helps the team stay together, and wherever Darren is, the people are going to kind of stay together. And then when he moves off and goes on to another team, that team might start to fall apart. But while he's there, he's just kind of glue that helps the team stay together. A great guy. I'm still in touch with him. And he's the one that I designated as, you know, look, I need you to lead this team. And he was able to keep that team together. So who you put on a team is going to have a tremendous influence on how that team is going to self-organize. Kind of stuff we've already talked about. Now, I mentioned earlier that sometimes we actually allow the team to choose who's on the team. So I'd like you to do for a couple minutes, we'll do one more discussion, I'll have you guys think about something, then I'll come back with the fifth, sixth, and seventh of these seven levers, we'll wrap up. But just for a couple minutes, I want you to think about this. Should a delivery team, this is one of the scrum teams or agile teams, be allowed full control over who's on the team? Should the team decide, hey, it's us, no, it's not her, it's her instead? Right? Should the team have that level of control all the time? And what are the advantages and disadvantages of that? So spend a few minutes talking about that. We'll share some thoughts, and I'll give you three more slides. We'll wrap up. Okay, let's come back together. What do you think? What do you think? Should a delivery team, an agile team, be allowed full control over who's on the team? No.
Why not?
Sometimes.
I've just never seen it work.
Okay. Well, that's a good reason, right? I can't give you a philosophical reason, but I've tried it, I've seen this, and I've never seen it be successful. Perfectly valid valid reason in my mind. I heard a couple other thoughts.
The delivery team might not be aware of all of the business-related criteria for selecting on the team.
Okay. They may not know all of the goals we're after. They may not know all of their own strengths and weaknesses, right? They may not have the right insight into that.
But if you have a team that you're happy with how they work, how they work together, and you don't want to disrupt that chemistry, you might allow them to pick up somebody else from the team.
Mm-hmm. Yep. If a team is going pretty well, I'm pretty reluctant to change things, right? I'm not big into, hey, let's just change, right? So I like teams to be fairly persistent over time. Would there be any circumstances where you'd let the team totally do this?
It could work with constraints. The team can't be larger than 10 people,
mm-hmm.
And they have to take full responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Or it could work. It could be very, very productive. Also be as much of, pardon the expression, good old boys that,
We'll often self-select individuals that work exactly like us, right? I want people who agree with me, right? I'm okay allowing teams a lot of flexibility in this. I'm not real wild about saying, hey, it's totally up to you, just go figure it out, right? I'll give you one example of something I've done with this, which is I've had policies when I was the vice president of a group where if... the team came to me and said, this guy's not working out. I'd look into it, and if they weren't just, jerks and wanted to get rid of somebody, I would move the person to another team. I'd find another team for that person. If the person kind of bombed out of a second team, I'd say, look, you got two sprints, two iterations. Go find a home. right? You've got two teams. You're a free team member. Walk up to any team you want and say, I'm free. Would you like me? If you can't find a home inside of two sprints, you're out of here. And then what I did is I pulled them on special projects for me. Well, the HR department made me do that, right? I would pull them on special projects for me. Meanwhile, I told them, look, you're out of here as soon as I can do all the paperwork. Start looking for a job, right? I'm doing you a favor telling you this now. And then, you know, all company resources available for you. Go print your resume on the laser printer. I don't care. I'm talking about doing this in a good way, right? We call it counseling out. You're counseling the person out of the organization. And then meanwhile, I had to do whatever HR paperwork to make that happen. Okay. Reconfiguring the network, a fifth lever that we can use to alter the evolutionary path of the team. If we think about the team as a network of individuals, we can reconfigure the network, how they interact. If you think about this picture up here, I've got three different teams, and then I've drawn their communication paths. Each team has all members talking to each other. And then I just drew a few random lines. You know, this guy or this woman talks to that woman on the other team, and she talks to that guy on the middle team. I just drew a few random interactions between the teams. But if you look at this and think about how many interactions there are, how many black lines, compared to how many people there are, the interactions swamp the number of individuals in a typical network. Right? So one of the things that we can do to influence how a team evolves, reconfigure the network, change these interactions. Let me show you an example of one that I was real impressed with. This is the idea of we've got two teams, one in the U.S., one in Russia. And this idea is something from an article written by Jeff Sutherland and a few of his colleagues and one of his clients that was at the Hicks conference about a year and a half ago, and actually 2 years ago now. And he described a situation where they had team in U.S., the team in Russia. Now, they could have set it up this way, but what they chose to do instead, and this is how a lot of people might look at this by default, what they chose to do instead was to set up the teams this way. They set up the first team to be half in the U.S., half in Russia, the second team half in the U.S., half in Russia. Most of us might have looked at this and said, hey, let's avoid those big, nasty communication problems. Let's have a U.S. team and a Russian team, right? Well, they looked at this and thought about all of the potential communication issues we might have if we have completely separate teams. And they chose to create what I call deliberately distributed teams. They had an appropriate skill set in each city. They could have left these alone, but they deliberately distributed these teams. This is a great example of reconfiguring the network. And in his paper, he goes on to talk, he doesn't talk about reconfiguring the network. He's not trying to write about it from this perspective. But this is one example of a really smart guy looking at a team and saying, hey, the right way for me to get them to self-organize is to put this clump of people together. Right? Probably not how they would have chosen to self-organize on their own. Right? If we'd just given it up to them. The sixth tool we can use, evolved vicarious selection systems. Right, so let's go back to our variation, selection, and retention for a moment. Right? The selection system was the selection of that long-necked giraffe to be able to breed, more likely to breed, and then retain that mutation. This takes a long time. Right? Giraffe has to grow to maturity, breed, have babies, get selected again. It takes a long time. It takes a long time for the marketplace to decide which of our products are successful. Right? I can't put two teams together, have to build two completely separate products, and then wait for the market to decide which one was best, and then be able to infer a lot from that about, oh, which team structure can we use going forward? It would take a long time to get enough data that way. So what we can do instead is create in our organizations what are called vicarious selection systems. A faster-paced selection system that does the same thing. It finds ways to favor good projects, good team organizations. Right? One of the best examples would be something like Google's well-known 20% policy. Right? Google tells its employees, you get 20% of your time to go find something good to work on. Right? They got a lot of smart employees. Those smart employees look around and find good things to work on. If you see them gravitating towards good products or gravitating towards working on certain things, they've got groups that have gravitated towards spending their time on improving testing, on introducing Agile into the organization. If you see that happen, I bet that's a good reason for that. That's a selection system. right? We've set up this thing. Hey, smart people, go spend 20% of your time on things. Where they choose to spend their time, we can look at and go, hey, that's a trait, like a long neck, that we want to retain. Right? Now let's find ways to formalize that, perhaps, or put more investment into that and make those things happen faster, happen more formally. Right? So there's lots of stories about Google's 20% policy. People go off, start little projects. Project starts to attract attention from people in their 20% time. Google makes it a formal project. That's a vicarious selection system. Right? So find ways to do things in our organizations. Last point, in terms of influencing the evolutionary path of a team, energize the system. Pump energy into the system. One of my favorite books is this book called Teamwork by Larson O. Afasto. And they talk about what's necessary for a successful team. And they said, teams need a clear, elevating goal. Team with a clear, elevating goal is more likely to succeed than one without. I read another book that had a very similar conclusion recently. That book was called Hotspots by Linda Grattan at the bottom here. And she says teams need what she called an igniting purpose. Right? If you have a team that has an igniting purpose, you ignite their passion around this, and they get excited about it, they're going to go outperform a team that's not excited. This is pumping energy into the situation, right? I can do that with motivation. I can do a project charter. Jim Highsmith, in one of his books, talks about project chartering, creating vision boxes and things like that. I've got a couple other techniques. I like writing magazine reviews, writing press releases. Right? Opportunity. Do well on this, and we'll move you on to another project. You can choose your next project. Right? So all sorts of ways to pump energy into the system. I want to show you one of probably the most famous example of pumping energy into a system. It was back in May, I think it was May 25th, 1995, when Microsoft woke up about the internet, right? And Bill Gates sent probably the most famous memo around, which was his internet tidal wave memo, right? He sent to all Microsoft employees. This is a direct quote from his email. It said, of course, because it was a memo, it wasn't an email. But it's a well-known email because this was part of their Department of Justice trial, right? The internet is a tidal wave. It changes the rules. It is an incredible opportunity as well as an incredible challenge. Think about this in terms of an igniting purpose. I am looking forward to your input on how we can improve our strategy to continue our track record of incredible success. Right? Bill. Imagine getting that, right? Big part of a big long memo, and this was kind of like the heart of the memo, where he says the internet's a tidal wave. This is going to wash over us. We've got to be a part of this. I look forward to your thoughts. All the Microsoft employees, smart people, what are we going to do about this? This was pumping energy into the system, right? He wasn't saying, here's what we're going to do. I know the answer. We're going to form this way, this way, this way. He was pumping energy into the system, right? Okay. So I'm going to wrap up there. A lot of this is from a new book I'm working on, which I'll mention this. There's the URL for the book. The book is called Succeeding with Agile. Actually, it's going to be called Succeeding with Agile Software Development with Scrum is the subtitle. Succeeding with Agile Software Development with Scrum. And so Succeeding with Agile is the website for the book. I'm posting chapters up there as PDFs. So if you're interested in what we're talking about, this book is up there. It's kind of a guide to getting started and getting good at Agile. The material that we just talked about today is all from Chapter 12, which is called Leading the Self-Organizing Team. It's kind of one of my favorite chapters, which is why I wanted to talk about it. This is just something I'm excited about because I really feel like people are left at a loss of like what is leadership and management about on Agile projects and don't quite know what to do. So this book will be out sometime in the summer or fall of this year. It's going along pretty well. Probably 300 pages have been posted up on the website, so it's coming along, but there's always a lot to do. And here's my contact information. I've also got business cards up here somewhere, so if you want a business card at the end, come up and grab that. And otherwise, I'm done.